Are you the one keeping everything together in your family, but maybe you're secretly or not so secretly falling apart?
Dude, you are not alone. We have been there too.
I'm Joanne.
And I'm Bree, and we're the hosts of the No Guilt Mom podcast.
If your to-do list never ends, your kids depend on you for everything, and you're constantly putting your own needs last.
Or if you're the go-to parent, but you're starting to feel burnt out and resentful, we're here to help.
Each week, we give you practical strategies from parenting and psychology experts and from our own Real Mom experience to help you take back time, energy, and joy.
So you can stop feeling like you're the family martyr and start leading as a confident, guilt-free role model.
Subscribe to the No Guilt Mom podcast and let's help you ditch the overwhelm and actually enjoy your family again.
Listen now wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Y'all. If you are a queer parent, and I have a feeling you might be, and you're dreaming of the ultimate family getaway, you have to check this out, y'all. Gays with Kids is hosting their fifth annual LGBTQIA+ Family Spring Break from April 2nd through April 6th, 2026. Mark that on your calendars. It is going to be the perfect mix of fun, community, and a beautiful chance to build real connections with other LGBTQ families, like mine, because we're going to be there. We're going to be there, too, and I want to see you there. This is it going to be three nights aboard Royal Caribbean International, cruising through the Bahamas, surrounded by other amazing queer families. If this sounds like your kind of trip, because it does for me, you're going to head to the link in the show notes to grab your spot. Oh, and don't forget to mention that you heard about it from the Queer Family Podcast. And come say hi to me when you're there. Okay, I hope to see you there. Let's get on with this show.
The Queer Family Podcast. Love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love.
There's quite a bit of research where people went looking for all of the ways that children might be harmed by having two parents of the same gender or sex. And in fact, it turned out that the opposite was true, that, you know, queer spawn are healthy and happy and generally very well adjusted
and kind
compared to their heterosexually parented counterparts.
Yeah. Welcome to the Queer Family Podcast, y'all. The show all about family, but with gay. I'm Jamie. I'm your gay host. And this is the show that celebrates, highlights, uplifts, and normalizes LGBTQIA+ families in all of our beautiful identities. And aren't we beautiful, y'all, in all of our identities? Can I get an amen? Yes. Thank you so much. I'm really excited to share this episode with you today, because it's a very heartwarming episode and it's going to give you some good feels. And I think this week especially, we could all use some good feels. Am I right? So I'm recording this 1 week away from the 2024 election with my queen, Kamala Harris, and he who shall not be named. And I'm on pins and needles, and it's a week out. And so if you're listening to this on the first day this episode drops, tomorrow is election day. And if you're listening to this after, you might know the results of the election. And I hope to God it goes the way this community, this queer community, needs it to go. And I don't want to put any bad juju out there in the air, so I'm going to just leave it at that. All I'm saying is I hope we all feel good. And I thought it would be great to have an episode that helps us to feel good regardless of the outcome. So I am excited to share with you this interview that I had with S. Bear Bergman. Bear is a writer and an activist and an educator, an all-around good human being. He's also a parent who happens to be trans. And he really just offers so much wonderful insight just into queerness in general and advocating for ourselves and being strong supporters of ourselves and our community. And I think that's an important message and story to hear right now. So I'm excited for you to hear from Bear. This episode is also a really rich source of inspiration for parents who are navigating raising children in a consciously inclusive environment, which I think most of us who listen to this year's show are doing our best to do. So I hope you enjoy it. And I was planning on, I recently came under attack by some MAGA heads on my social media, on the TikTok, because I posted a video about why I wanted Kamala to win. And one of the reasons is that I want my white young son to see that a strong Black and South Asian woman can hold the most powerful position in his country and do so with grace and expertise. And I got a lot of backlash. I got some maggots got a hold of it. And then they're like maggots. They come at you. Like, it's like cockroaches. They're swarming me. Anne and I have had a little bit of fun reading some of their asinine comments and trying to laugh at them. Some of them are really just funny. And I was going to read some of them for you. And then I thought, you know what? No, I'm not going to read you those comments because I don't want to fuel any fire. I want to leave you with a message of love and support and hope. And I have, it's fun, oddly enough, Bear Bergman has a publishing company, children's inclusive publishing book company called Flamingo Rampant. And I'm in love with it. I just got all these books from Bear's publishing company. And I thought it would be great to read a hopeful poem from one of the children's books that I recently got from Bear's publishing company. It's from a book titled Power Poems for Small Humans. And it's one of the first poems in the book. And this poem was written by Andrea Gibson. And I think it's a nice little message of hope. So I'm going to leave y'all with this. I don't know the future. And it's okay that I don't know. The sky was expecting sunshine. Then my tongue was catching snow. I can handle whatever comes my way. I can handle what doesn't, too. Maybe cows expected to chirp like birds. Then, holy cow, they mooed. You see what he did there? I love it. I think it's a sweet message. And I hope y'all are taking really good care of yourself. And lastly, I'm going to leave you with some Ani DiFranco lyrics because I am just a real strong-hearted lesbian at heart. And it goes something like this. Sing it along in your heads if you'd like. Buildings and bridges were made to bend in the wind. To withstand the world, that's what it takes. All that steel and stone are no match for the air, my friends. What doesn't bend, breaks. What doesn't bend, breaks. What doesn't bend, breaks. Good song. If you know the song, I hope you sang along. And it's so true. We're going to make it through. Regardless of the outcome, we got this, y'all. We got this. We are a strong, resilient community, and we will make it through no matter what. Because when we fall down, we get back up and we keep on going. All right. I love y'all. Here we go. Let's do this. I'll see you soon. Enjoy the episode. Oh, Helen Beulah. I almost forgot to bring Helen and Beulah into the conversation. Helen Beulah, they're just drinking. You know how they do. Please roll that tape. Thank you so much.
Queer Family Podcast. Love is love.
Hi, Bear.
Hi.
Nice to have you here virtually in my virtual recording studio. I hope your day is going well.
So far, it's, you know, it's the morning. You have children. You know what the mornings are like. There's a lot of, do you have your shoes? Do you have your lunch?
Oh.
Do you have your agenda?
I just went through it and I managed to not lose my temper this morning. So like, I feel like that's a win.
Oh yeah, A plus.
Thank you. Thank you. It doesn't happen often that I don't lose it on them at some point in the morning.
Here's the thing I don't understand. My children have had feet their whole lives.
Right.
We live in Canada where it gets, they've never been allowed to just walk out in their bare feet to go to school ever. Not even one time. Why am I still reminding them that they need their shoes for feet that they are theoretically already aware of having? I have several questions about this.
They have had them their whole lives.
They're not surprise feet. I don't know.
I'll tell you what, Bear, I have gotten, we live in a Manhattan apartment, so we have to walk down the hall to an elevator. We have literally gotten in an elevator And I have looked down and said, where are your shoes? What the hell? It is a thing. What is that?
I don't know. I am aware that sometime in the double digits, they do seem to eventually connect the concept of leaving the house with the concept of putting on shoes. But I'm surprised every morning that it's like, oh, my shoes. Like, that's like, it's like, this is a new initiative that we're trying out at our house.
It's so true. Thank you. I needed this laugh. You're so right. And the morning routine is awful. And I don't wish it on anyone. It really is. Like, and also don't text me when I'm in the morning routine. I'm not going to answer you. There's a lot of yelling. There's a lot of stern talking going on. There's no time for texting.
It's definitely my mother's. My parents are also on Eastern time. And I'm on 2 hours earlier, and it's definitely my mother's favorite time of the day to text me with some critical thing like, yeah, have you ever roasted tomatoes?
I love it. I don't understand.
Can we please discuss this in a half an hour?
I don't have time for this right now. For me, it's the group chats. The group chats always start up at 7:50 when I'm trying to get these children out the dang door. And, you know, in a group chat, then it's just like, bing, bing, bing. I'm like, what? What could be so, you know, it stresses me out. Anyway.
Or you're one friend who texts like a teenager. And so one thought takes five texts. And so five times in a row, and you therefore think maybe something urgent is, but no, they're just having a feeling about their accessories that they would like to share with you.
I have to tell you, I think I might be that friend, but not the morning routine time. But never, not at that hour. Never. No. It's usually at night after a couple glasses of wine. Anywho. Okay. All right. Let's get into this. We need to know, Bear, who you are and why you're here on the Queer Family Podcast. So I think it's about time for your 30-second elevator pitch. Are you ready for this, Bear?
I hope so.
On your mark, get set, go.
Hi, I'm Bear Bergman. I'm a queer and trans father and writer. I have been a queer and trans activist since I was a teenager in the 90s when I first came out at 15 years old. And I was one of the founding members of the first ever Gay Straight Alliance, which was my best 16-year-old idea. And I've been writing and performing about queer and trans topics ever since.
Boom! You did it. Wow. I'm impressed and I'm excited for this conversation.
Well, I am a professional talker, so I feel like if I can't hit a 30-second mark by this point, I've got different problems that no one can help me with.
Like a true professional. I make all my guests do this, and then sometimes it gets flipped on me and I can't do it. So congrats.
Thank you.
I'm a bit of a rambler. If you haven't figured that out already. Yeah. Yeah. You deserve the congratulating. Okay. So Bear, can we take this back before we get into the amazing work you're doing now? And you have a new book out that we want to talk about. Before we get into that, can we go back to, you said you came out at, did you say 15?
Yes. In 1991, I was a 15-year-old high school student attending boarding school in Concord, Massachusetts. And some friends of mine, it was a small independent school with a pretty artsy, sort of socially progressive vibe. And we even had a couple of out queer teachers at that point, which, you know, it was not very long then. Yeah. And it hadn't been very long since, you know, what's her name? Anita Bryant, the orange juice lady, tried to ban queer people from teaching in Florida.
Which spread then to California. Yes.
I came out as queer, and then I pretty promptly got started doing queer youth activism as a teenager.
Wow, good job. Go you.
I mean, to be fair, I was pretty well supported as a student at a school that was overall pretty LGBTQ positive. I would also say that I had another thing on my side, which is, and follow me for a second, but after we left New York and my parents moved us to Connecticut, I was, for a long time, one of a very few Jewish students in my school. And that meant that I developed a certain amount of, like, ability to play friendly ambassador with snacks for my people, who you may not know a lot about, but we're fun. And I'm, you know, like, at Hanukkah, I would go in, like, we're Jewish. This is a menorah.
Here is have a dreidel.
Yeah. Right? Exactly. Yes, 100%. And oh, so, you know, 10 years later, when I came out as queer and I found myself in a situation where I was one of a fairly few at that time queer teenagers that was out, I kind of relied on those skills again that I had developed explaining Passover to my fellow third graders. I felt some responsibility about it too, I think. And I started doing a lot of very public activism about that queer teenagers existed and that that was fine, that we were just normal. Like people who were, I mean, I don't know about normal, but certainly, you know, one of the many kinds of people that happen in the world and that there was nothing to be concerned about.
That's really amazing. I love this. And so you come out at 15, you know you're queer. Was there any way to act on your queerness? Was there any way to live a queer life? I mean, were you the only one around of your peer group? Or you just intrinsically knew inside that you were queer?
I mean, I think a couple of things were going on. One, there were a couple of other students at our school who were queer and somewhat out, you know, sometimes in the way that a certain genders of young people don't really get a lot of choice about whether they're out or not. But I also was at that time, I participated a lot in online communities. In addition to being a junior queer, I was also a junior nerd. Well, it gave me access to older queer people, right? Like queer adults who were able to help me make sense of what was going on for me and answer some of my questions. And then fairly shortly, some friends and I started the Gay Straight Alliance. And I also went to a queer youth group in Boston called Bagley, which at the time was Boston Alliance of Gay and Lesbian Youth. And now it's called something more inclusive. But, you know,
right, of course.
It's important to remember in the early 90s, just saying lesbian and gay was considered forward thinking instead of just saying gay.
Yeah. And that's it. That's what we had. And bi. But bi was not really fully accepted.
I remember in 1993, the March on Washington. I don't know how old you are. I'm 50.
We're close. I'm 46. So same era.
Yeah. You might remember the 1993 March on Washington when they announced that it was going to be the March on Washington for lesbian, gay, and bisexual rights. A certain group of people lost their stuff completely.
Yeah, because how dare you?
How dare we invite the bisexuals?
Right.
So, you know, these days when people are like, I don't know, does this group of people belong under the queer umbrella? Does that group of people belong under the queer umbrella? I just find myself thinking, like, I can't believe 35 years later, we are still having this fight. I am exhausted by it.
I understand. Also, I was just at an event last night. I keep meaning to Google this. Maybe you have an answer. Barry, you seem to have a lot of knowledge, so I'm going to ask you this. You know, it's LGBTQIA plus, right? However, we certain people say it. Some people only say LGB. Some people will only say LGBT. Some people will say LGBTQI. And I still do not know why. What is it? Are they intentionally keeping letters off of it? Because I always try to just say as many as I can think of. I say them all because I want to be, it is my goal in life to just be inclusive of all identities and everyone. But I have noticed I was at an event last night and they said it so many different ways. Every speaker got up and said it different. And it's not because they're not used to the acronym. It's not because it wasn't flowing freely, right? It was a choice. And I'm still confused about what is that choice? Why? Do you know anything about it, Bear?
I guess I know two things about it. As a speaker, what I would say is that like the first time I always will say lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer, intersex, asexual, and other associated identities. And I like to say all the words rather than just the letters.
I like that there.
Partly because I get frustrated with people say, oh, they're LGBTQ. Like all of those at the same time? Or are you just trying to avoid having to say queer? Like, what's happening here? It's not a sandwich. Like, or I mean, you know, sometimes after dark, maybe it is a sandwich, but it, like, we're not referring to a sandwich. But then after a while, especially if I'm talking for an hour, I very often will start shorthanding to just queer and trans. Or, you know, trans, non-binary, genderqueer, whatever, right? Like I will shorten it up.
Specify.
Sometimes specify and sometimes just sort of gloss, like Alphabet Mafia, Rainbow Collective, you know, whatever.
Well, I like to say LGBTQIA because I think it sounds fun.
Yes, absolutely. But then I think there's another thing, and I feel like all of those are basically fine and fun. Like, I'm looking for somebody to make sure that they're including everybody at least periodically, but I don't necessarily have a lot of feelings about it, especially over a longer time if one speaker sort of, you know, does the whole thing once and then shorthands after that.
Yeah.
But I do notice that a certain ideological perspective of person will say, advise, you know, they'll very specifically say LGB.
Yeah.
And in those cases, what I experience is that they are trying to do something that A, I find offensive, and B, I don't think is possible, which is separate trans, non-binary, and genderqueer people from lesbian, gay, and bi people as though those things are not related, which is provably false and also, I think, quite small-minded.
Yeah, I agree. And in the name of inclusion and in the name of community and in the name of all of us needing a very strong community in the face of the rhetoric that is spewn about many of us, some more than others. I do think that we should be a united front here and be included in the entire umbrella, which is why I love the word queer, because I feel like it just includes us all. It looks like I have a ghost opening the door, but that was actually my dog. She's a regular occurrence here in this recording studio. That's also my bedroom. Anyway, that we digress yet again. I have a feeling this is going to be a lot of digressing, and I'm down for that with you, Bear, because I feel like I said before, I feel like you have a lot of knowledge on things, and I want to pick your brain.
I mean, I think I have just been a queer pain in the ass for so long that I've seen some things, really.
Listen, there's something to that. There's something to seeing some things. Now, we have alluded to your children, so Can we dive into the forming of your family and what that looked like and how you got to it?
Yes, tell me. I definitely have children. I have three. The eldest is technically my stepdaughter, although I more regularly refer to her as the world's best ever free gift with purchase. Morgan, she's 29.
Oh,
I would like to say for the record that she thinks that this is this, you know, the way that I refer to her is both delightful and hilarious. I made that joke not that long ago and someone looked at me very concerned, like maybe I was saying something unkind about her. I assure you, I mean it very enthusiastically, and she takes it that way.
Right, right. Well, you're queer, so, you know, you could have bought her, you know, to be, to groom her.
Oh,
as,
God.
As the folks think out there in the world.
That's, I mean, unfortunately, I fear that that is what some people must be afraid that I'm alluding to. I can't.
I mean, I hope not.
The reoccurrence of the groomer narrative, again, ugh, after all of this time, like, that was from the early, late 80s, early 90s. Like, that is old and tired and so disproven that I can't believe we're bringing it back now. But that's a different, we'll talk about that later, maybe.
Yeah, history has repeated itself in a big way. Yeah.
And then my husband, Jay, and I have two co-productions, Sheer, who is 14, and Solomon, who is 9.
Oh, and wow. Okay.
That is it. There will be no, I was in the airport the other day and I was having a conversation with a woman who had like a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. And I was playing peekaboo with the 2-year-old because the kids were just like, you know, having a lot of pre-flight spilkes. Uh-huh. And she asked me if I said, made some comment about how nobody at my house is your size anymore. And the woman asked me, you know, how old my kids were. And I said, and then I made a joke and I said, and that's it. Like, we will not be having any more. And she said, well, you never know. Anything could happen. And I didn't say, like, ma'am, if we have an oops at our house, there's a whole other, that's not happening.
Doesn't really happen in our beds, but
no, we're trying. I'll, you know, I
try give it all
a,
the time.
I give it a good go, but so far nothing.
So how did the two of you go about creating your children? Because we do dive into that a lot on this show, because there's so many paths to parenthood, and no two stories are the same when it comes to queer families and queer folks. So would you mind going into that a little?
No, not at all. I met my husband at a conference in Milwaukee. We were supposed to be having a one-night stand.
Same.
Then it turned into a weekend fling.
Same.
Now we've been together for 17 and a half years.
Close, me and my wife.
So that worked out. I feel like good choices were made. Pretty much the second conversation that Jay and I had, you know, with our clothes on, was him saying, you know, and we were in our, I'm trying to think, I guess we were 33, 34 mm-hmm. when we mm-hmm. met, was him saying, I want to be a parent and I am actively trying right now to make that happen. And if you want to, you know, get on this ride, great, but you need to know that I am stopping at Progeny Station as soon as possible. So be advised.
Had he already like started the process? He was going to be like a single parent by choice?
Yes, he was going to be a single parent by choice. He was talking to people about sperm donation. He's also trans. He was talking to people about sperm donation, and he was talking to people about various kinds of like co-parenting, known donor, other kinds of arrangements, and just was very clear, like, I'm doing it. Like, I'm making babies. And if we're going to be together, you should know now.
Okay. And how'd that go down?
Well, I will tell you, up until that moment, I had felt pretty clear that I was not interested in having my own children. Mm-hmm. I spent actually quite a bit of my leisure time trying to help people undo the parenting that they had received.
Right.
As sort of a like community help guy kind of you know, dad about town. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, up until that moment, I thought, I don't want to be responsible for doing parenting. Parenting just seems like a thing that, you know, is often injurious to people. But, you know, love will change your mind. And I was completely smitten with his everything, honestly. Mm-hmm. I never met anyone who had so many ideas. Right? Like, he's great looking and he has a really cute butt and he's a fantastic kisser and he's, you know, interesting to talk to and all the rest of it. But the thing that really hooked me was he's such an original thinker. And I was like, okay, well, right? Like, I was done for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I said, okay, I'm in.
So, okay.
Yes, we will. That's children. I was just thinking that was what I wanted to do. And so that was kind of it. He was pretty clear that he wanted to get started right away. And we talked a lot, even right at first, about how we intended to accomplish this.
Yes, because you have to.
Yes.
You're going to figure it out.
He wanted to be pregnant, and I definitely did not.
Right.
So that part was easy and straightforward. And we both had a moderate preference for a known donor,
uh-huh.
which, you know, I have no feelings one way or another about, not because I'm, you know, against like anonymous donors or any of that. I just, I started looking through catalogs and thinking like, oh, maybe we're just picking someone who's very good at filling out forms.
Which is quite possible.
Yes. And that was like my thing that I just couldn't get past. And we knew a couple of people who made sperm and were willing to share some with us.
That's a good head start.
Yes. So we met in 2007 in April. By the time we got married in May of 2009, he was 7.5 weeks pregnant on our wedding day.
Wow. That's amazing. So you went, you did it.
Listen, when when Jay decides, that's what we're doing. And so we had Sheer, and then we were sort of divided on whether we wanted to go again. And then after about 3.5 years, we decided that we would go again. And we had Solomon in 2015.
With same donor or different donor?
Donor? Same donor.
Same. That's amazing. And donor is in your life?
Yeah. He's great. He is now, he wasn't at the time, but he is now married and has a couple of kids of his own who are sort of, you know, cousins to our children in the family discussion. We really lucked out. I definitely know a number of people whose known donor situations have been difficult in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think through a combination of thoughtful choosing and quite a lot of conversation ahead of time and, you know, pretty clear expectations. And I also think just like pure luck.
I have a couple questions because I love to dig in deep when it comes to the baby making, because, you know, there are no manuals out there as of yet for us queer folks. There are some books coming. There are some books, but it is wonderful to hear stories firsthand.
Oh, for sure.
Did you use a lawyer or get any legal papers drafted up about what the relationship would be?
No, because we were advised that no legal agreement that we did before the child was born had really any legal weight.
Mm-hmm.
What we did was we all contributed to a document of our intentions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we are all sort of, I would say, very feelings forward, fairly queerly enculturated people. And so we sat and talked a lot about what if this, what if that, what if the other thing, what, you know, what were the big fears, what were the big excitements, and we wrote them all down and, you know, passed a three or four page document back and forth until we all felt like we were represented in the ways that we wanted, including practical things, you know, like that the donor didn't have financial responsibilities or whatever, but also a lot of emotional things, you know, what if this and what if that, and what would the kid's relationship to his parents be like, and what if he eventually had children, and so on and so forth. And then we just kind of went for it. I think it helped to some degree that we did live in Canada by that time, where Jay and I could both be on the birth certificate from the beginning, and we all wanted that to be the case. And again, I think some of it was preparation, and some of it was vibes, and some of it was just really lucking out.
Well, it sounds like you were really thorough and really intentional in walking through it together, which is amazing. And then also, yes, luck, right?
Yeah, I definitely know people who were not any less careful, intentional, thoughtful than we were, who ended up in situations that were very challenging for them legally, emotionally, spiritually. And I don't want to leave the impression that I think we had a good result because we did an unimpeachably good job. I think there are a lot of people doing equally good jobs, and other circumstances intervene that they couldn't have predicted. I will say that, you know, Jewish weddings include a contract called the ketubah. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but a ketubah in a Jewish wedding sort of does two things. It spells out all of the obligations of the people getting married to one another. And it also spells out in the wedding contract what will happen in case of a divorce. Oh. Like who gets what and how people will be taken care of. Mm-hmm. And I think to some degree, you know, all of us are Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I think something about having the cultural expectation already that it was appropriate and wise to plan for a potential bad time, even in the middle of all of our joy and optimism, and really dig into like, okay, but what will happen if... Mm-hmm. You know, something difficult is to occur. Like, what if Jay and I split up? What if one of the children needed a tremendous additional support or care? Like, what would we do? Mm-hmm. I think that already having that template where you, you know, prepare for the potential worst, even when you are at your most optimistic, really helped us to take that agreement of our intentions very seriously and really invest emotionally in it.
It's interesting because I've actually spoken to parents who've gotten divorced, queer parents who've gotten divorced, who have said, if I had done it differently, I would have planned for this before. Like, and said, not to sound really dark and dismal here, but you should talk all of this out so you know. Mm-hmm. So you have a blueprint for what's going to happen, you know, things change always. And I always say as well, like the known donor situation and the anonymous donor situation can go smashingly beautifully and it can go smashingly wrong. And it's up to you to decide what you want to put in place and what, if you want to bring a lawyer in. think through all of this, all of these things, because unfortunately, we have to use outside sources to create our families. Mm-hmm. Most of us, most of the time, not every single time.
Yes.
Most of the time. And so I have another question for you.
Okay.
Did you do like an at-home insemination? Did you go to a clinic? How did y'all work that out? We'll be right back.
Queer Family Podcast, love is love.
Love is love.
We did cycle monitoring at a clinic, and then we did at-home insemination after that. Although none of the inseminations actually happened at our home for a variety of procedural reasons. One of them happened in a hotel, and one of them happened at our donor's house.
Because it was fresh sperm, I'm assuming.
Yes. Yep.
Right. So yep. It would be kind of like, okay, it's that time. So come on over and deposit your sperm, for lack of a better term. And
here's a cup.
Yeah. Here's your cup. And
then 10 minutes.
Right. And then you got right to it, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you use something like the Mosey baby kit or anything? Or did you use just a syringe you found at a store? All these details, it sounds like I'm so nosy, and I am. However, these details all matter when it comes to this stuff.
I don't know what kind of kit that is. I'm not familiar. We used the syringes that our reproductive endocrinologist gave us with in an individual packages with little, the flexible end situation.
I have talked to many people over 200 episodes. I don't think I've talked to anybody who actually got their syringes at the clinic, which is interesting. I've talked to people who bought them on Amazon or they have these kits now, like the Mosey baby kit. And it's like it's like for at-home insemination, and it gives you everything you need.
I mean, we read Taking Charge of Your Fertility, that book. And we had, a clipboard and a thermometer and a chart and a graph and a whatever. although, honestly, we relied on physical signs the most to be like, oh, it's time. It worked out pretty well.
It sounds like it did. You were lucky. And one more thing I just want to clarify. In the States, we can both go on the birth certificate, but that doesn't necessarily signify parentage. It does not legally bind both people as parents, which is why they highly advise in the States to get a second parent adoption. I'm assuming it's different in Canada. Like if you're on the birth certificate, you're both assumed the parents, which is amazing.
The Canadian birth certificate does bind the people to the child and vice versa. And in fact, I'm going to say 10 years ago, but it could be longer. There was a landmark case in Canada about having more than two parents on the birth certificate. It's called the AABBCC case, if people want to look it up. Because they anonymized the petitioners. But it was two lesbians and a gay man, I think, but it could have been two gay men and a lesbian, some homosexuals who wanted to make a baby and co-parent that baby as a unit and did not feel that they should have to decide which two of them were the real, in air quotes, parents of this child. And so they petitioned to have all of the names on the birth certificate and won. And so now by special, like you still have to file an additional form, but you can now file an additional form and have up to four parents named on one child's birth certificate.
Wow.
Oh, Canada.
Go ahead, Canada. Canada, man, Canada rocks. I love Canada. That's amazing.
I mean, to be fair, it has been the result of a lot of people's work, right? Canada didn't just wake up one day like Cinderella surrounded by beautiful birds and squirrels and say, let's extend some extra parental rights to, you know, people parenting in non-traditional families. There were a series of court cases that meant that, you know, two people of the same sex could be on a birth certificate in the first place. And, you know, things proceeded from there through the courts, but it was eventually made possible.
I suppose I should say Canadians rock. Canadians. Canadians for making the work happen. That's really awesome. Amazing. You got your two kids and Jay carried both of them?
Oh, yes.
And they were Jay's eggs.
Yes.
Fantastic. And you had both, when you met, you had both transitioned.
Yes.
Can you talk? And I want to talk about your book so bad and all the other things, but I am nosy. And so I want to know all the things. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like as two trans men pregnant, like being pregnant in the world as a trans man? I know you can't speak to Jay's experience because you don't speak for Jay.
I don't, though I definitely did have a, you know, I was there for all of it. I would say that we were really helped by the fact that we are both educators and activists around queer issues since forever. You know, I started as a teenager and he started as a slightly older teenager. But one of the things that initially really bonded us was our work on LGBTQI, and now I'm very aware that IA, two-spirit plus topics, even as young people. And I think also we a little bit bonded about the fact that by the mid-2000s, when people were saying, oh, it's time, you know, we just started thinking about queer youth. He and I would just sort of exchange a look like, I mean, welcome.
Welcome to the conversation.
We've been at it already for 15 years, but hi. And I think we used all of those skills in order to figure out how to deal with the, you know, baby making industrial complex or whatever, and also to activate our queer networks for advice and support and, you know, help. We went into the reproductive endocrinologist that we wanted and said, this is the deal. This is what we're trying to do. Will you help us? And they said what is actually my favorite thing to hear as a trans person in any medical setting, which was, we don't really know anything, but if you teach us, we will do what you think is best. And I have learned that that is actually my favorite answer, my favorite even more than, oh, great, we love it, we're so ready for you. Because mostly that does not turn out to be the case. What turns out to be the case is that they have like generally positive feelings about trans people, which is great, but they're not always willing to let us sort of start from the beginning and walk them through everything. So we really lucked out with, you know, the place that we went said, like, yes, we will help you make a baby. Absolutely. Tell us what we need to know. And we told them.
That's great.
To the point that when after Solomon, our second child that we had together was born, we went in for like, look, we made this visit to the doctor, and he said, oh, I was just at a big conference for reproductive endocrinologists, and they were talking about how many of you may have heard of the concept of trans men getting pregnant, and he's saying this, and I thought, oh, that's old news. He was so proud of himself.
That's really amazing.
I was delighted with him.
That's awesome. You found a good one.
We did. And we had amazing midwives that we worked with who, again, were like, well, we don't really know anything about it, but, you know, will tell us what we need to know. And as far as Jay being a pregnant man, it's shocking how much people do not expect to see a pregnant man. And so I think their brains just fill in any other reason that a person looks like that, like just a real, I don't know, like a real dedication to beer belly, or I'm not, you know, it was a lot of overalls and those chef wear pants. Uh-huh. Do you know the ones in the, like,
I do,
herringbone print?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
That,
yes.
That all the butches and all of the trans mask and, you know, non-binary, more masculinely gendered folks, I think, wear.
They're comfy.
At the end, certainly, mm-hmm. of their pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but to the point where when we went to the hospital to have the baby, the first one, we had been hoping for a home birth. That didn't happen for a variety of reasons, but it was okay. You know, we showed up and said, like, we are here to have a baby. And they were like, great, where is the baby's mother? And I'm standing next to my husband, who's like, you don't know, Jamie, he's so pregnant, right? He's 42 weeks pregnant with a baby that turned out to be 10 and a half pounds.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
It was like being in a soap opera where they hand you a three-month, they're like, congratulations. And they hand you a three-month-old with a full head of hair and eyes wide open.
My daughter was almost 10 pounds, and I felt that way. But 10 and a half, come on now.
So big. He's like out to here pregnant. And, you know, Margaret behind the desk just can't. Yes, in his overalls. And Margaret behind the desk just can't see it because she can't put pregnant and man together
right.
in her mind. And I think a lot of pregnant trans guys and, you know, pregnant, non-binary and genderqueer and other sort of masculinely gendered people who get pregnant have a lot of the same experience where people just like set phasers on ignore.
You see what you're conditioned to see, right?
Yeah.
Interesting. Huh. That is a really funny story, though. And how did that turn out? What did you say? Well, right here.
No, because so it turned out
there's
that
no mom.
One of our there's no mom. No, there's no mother should have been the, like, if I was going to make a scrapbook, that's what it would have called. There's no mother. One of our midwives who was so amazing, our midwifery team with our first baby was so amazing. And at that time, there was one article that had been published in like the Journal of Nursing about perinatal care for trans men. And she made 30 photocopies of it, gave one to everyone in labor and delivery at that entire hospital, had like a thing to post on the door that said, do not enter this room before you read this. And it included, like, you know, the right, Jay is a trans man. He uses he, him. He's, you know, going to be called Abba. You can say dad, right? Like a whole deal.
This is such a case for a midwife when it comes to queer folks right here. Holy shit, that I want a midwife now every time I go to the gynecologist. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to have to answer the awkward freaking questions and out myself again and again and again and again every time I go to the gynecologist.
Yeah.
And that's just on a tiny level. What a case for a midwife right there. Wow.
Well, and in Canada, midwives are licensed and they are a profession and they're covered under, you know, we have universal health care. And so if you want a midwife to have a baby, you can just pick that. And then that is what you get. You can have an OBGYN if that is what you want. Or you can have a a midwife. And for a variety of reasons, including this reason, that is what we chose. Anyway, the person behind the desk eventually was like, oh, you're the guys. I read it.
Which...
I read about this. I got a memo. And so,
oh wow.
And so there we were. The part that I always still feel very soft about is that she did that even though we were really planning a home birth, mm-hmm. but like she really went the extra mile to make sure that, or they, the whole practice really went the extra mile to make sure that they were as ready as they could be for us.
That you would be taken care of. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite stories about a midwife I think I've ever heard. So thank you for that.
Midwives rock.
Whew. I am really enjoying this conversation with you, Barry.
Me
this
too.
Is so fun. But I don't want to take all of your time. So I do want to let's dive into what your latest thing is, because you write.
I do.
And you have been writing and you have something new. So please tell us.
Well, I wrote a parenting book. And it is called Special Topics in Being a Parent, a queer and tender guide to things I learned about parenting, mostly the hard way.
Yeah.
It just came out a couple of weeks ago from Arsenal Pulp Press. You know, we talked a little bit when we were just chatting at the beginning about the problem of the morning rush. But oof. In fact, there is a whole chapter in that book about transitions and how hard they are.
Yeah.
And I know how that looks. I don't mean like transgender transitions. I mean the part where people have to like find their shoes and get their bag and stop doing one thing so they
yes.
can start doing the next thing and leave.
Put the water bottle in your bag. Put your lunch in the bag. All of these things need to be done. Yes, yes.
My husband likes to joke that we need to run a seminar called Putting Things in Things. just for children. Like putting the garbage in the garbage can, putting the laundry in the laundry basket, water bottle in the school bag. We're just going to focus this afternoon on putting things in things.
It's so
a user guide. I don't. Yes.
Oh my God. It's so true.
So true. So this book is illustrated and it's, I think, 18 chapters of the things that I have usually in retrospect, to be honest with you, figured out about parenting that I think might be useful to other people. The chapters are short, you know, the book is designed so if you have 7 to 10 minutes, you can read one chapter pretty easily, which frankly, as a parent, like
exactly.
Five, 7 minutes. That's it.
That's
700 interrupted minutes is like, that's a great day. I would say overall, it's a book for people who are trying to live their progressive values as parents, who maybe don't have a lot of modeling about what that looks like from the ways that they were parented.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And which I don't even necessarily mean as like a slight against how other people or some of us were parented, but things are different. We're having a lot different conversations in 2024 about children and what they need than we were in 1974, which is mm-hmm. when I was born. And I am hoping to help parents to kind of A, feel a little more kept company in trying to figure all that out.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's hard.
B, yeah. You know, open some conversations, show some pathways for things that we did. Sort of say, like, if you want a way to try, this is how we do it.
Yeah. I like that.
Give this a go.
You're not like saying, if you don't do such and such, your child will be devoid of intellect for the rest of their lives. Like those kinds of books. I hate those parenting books.
No. In fact, those kinds of books are part of why I ended up writing special topics in being a parent. And one of the chapters is called Zoom Out. Zoom Way Out. Because I think that we are all bombarded with all of these recommendations / imperatives about how much sleep, how much tummy time, how many vegetables, how much screen time, how much interactive play.
And there's pressure. There is so much pressure out there for us to do as parents. All of these things.
All of them every day.
Yeah.
And I would just like to say, you can take an average over a week or a month or a quarter, right? Like if I look only at today for sleep, you know, maybe it's okay. Maybe it's not okay. Am I a bad parent on the day that my kid doesn't get to bed on time, right? Or is it like, you know, whatever passes for bedtime on Halloween plus the night that everybody fell asleep early because we were in the swimming pool all afternoon.
Right, right.
Right? Like you put it all together.
Yeah.
And the average is usually pretty good.
You know, I like that.
Did my child watch Moana 3 times on a Sunday? Maybe.
It's a pretty good movie.
Then the previous day doing something, you know, more interactive and more wholesome.
Right.
Like at a certain point, I think the real question isn't, did you check every box every day? But in a month, are the kids getting like roughly enough sleep, roughly enough fruits and vegetables, roughly enough, I don't know, whatever spatial reasoning puzzles.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is that are, I can't even keep up. We were supposed to play Mozart. Then it turned out that that didn't actually do anything. We were supposed to, right? Like that's the thing about all of these parenting fads is that many of them, I think, like they're fine. I'm not against puzzles or museums or broccoli at all. But I also think like broccoli is delicious and so is cake.
Yes.
And that is a fine way to operate your life.
Crunchy little cheese balls are fine sometimes.
But also you're not a good parent the day your child eats the rainbow and a bad parent the day your child eats a piece of pizza in the back of the car on the way home from Target.
Yeah.
Right? Like fine. You're a good parent because you fed them and you're keeping them company.
Right.
That's the deal. That is perhaps my parenting philosophy in a nutshell. But that's the vibe of the book.
I love that.
Sorry you didn't get one. I will make sure that happens.
I'm going to go buy one. I'm excited. Zoom out. I love this. And give yourself some freaking grace because we're all doing our best. And I have to say, because I say this all the time, I do think queer parents are actually the best parents. So there's that. We're like super intentional. Like we know, you know, it took us a lot to create these little beings. So I joke, but I don't joke, but I joke.
I mean, statistically, kids of, you know, there's quite a bit of research where people went looking for all of the ways that children might be harmed by having two parents of the same gender or sex. And in fact, it turned out that the opposite was true, that, you know, queer spawn are healthy and happy and generally very well adjusted
and kind
compared to their heterosexually parented counterparts.
Which, yeah,
there's a comedian, Robin Tyler, who was popular in the 80s, who used to make a joke, and she would say that, you know, there are 6 admonitions in the Bible toward queer people and 371 toward heterosexuals. And that doesn't mean that doesn't mean that straight people are doing a bad job. They just need more guidance. And every time somebody starts in on me about how I am permanently damaging my children by raising them in a queer household, that is what I think of.
I like that. I'm going to think of that too. I'm going to go all to all the trolls I have on Facebook right now and just send them all the passages admonishing heterosexuals. There you go. Oh, this is really just, I love this. Everybody can go get your book. There will be a link in the show notes, everybody. Great, so go check the show notes. And I'm really excited and I'm excited to know you. I'm glad we got to have this conversation because this was a fun one.
Me too.
And I wish you all the best in your parenting journeys. And one thing I know is they're not playing those ads that they played when we were kids. It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are? They're not playing those for us. You know what I mean?
No, I definitely always know where my children are by 10 p.m.
Me too.
For
what
sure.
The hell? What I the mean, hell?
I don't, yeah. we're definitely more on the free range side of parenting. And I think city kids generally, you just sort of have to be like, you know, at a certain point, they take the bus, they take the subway, they go to the corner store. Like they have to develop the ability to do those things. But yeah, by 10 o'clock, I know where they are.
I know where they are at 10. It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children... Do you remember those ads? Oh, my God.
Oh, yes. Grace oh Slick God. Was in one of them. And it have was you all, ever...
Yeah,
go, celebrities. Go back and watch the Grace Slick one. It is so campy and perfect. It's like she really just... full send on that one. She's so funny about it.
There should just be a compilation of all of them somewhere. I bet you YouTube has that. Cyndi Lauper, I remember, was in one.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So funny. Well, anyway, I've taken up way too much of your time. This was awesome. Everybody, go get Bear's book. Is there anywhere else folks can follow you if they want to keep in touch with what you're doing and the books and the things and the stuff?
Absolutely. I'm on all of the social medias and I have a website, which is sbearbergman.com. And from there, you can see what books I'm working on and what shows I'm performing. And there's also a link to Flamingo Rampant, which we didn't even talk about. I also run a children's press that makes books that celebrate LGBTQIA2S. Plus kids and families and communities. Ooh. And we have almost 30 titles in print in children's picture books.
I bet you I have some of them on my kids' bookshelves right now. I have a feeling I have some of them, honestly, I think.
Zero Dads Club is a very popular title of ours. 47,000 Beads, Princess of Great Daring. I'll send you some books.
Oh my God. I love it. Oh, I would love that. We have so many. My daughter is outgrowing them, but they're still great for my son. He's 6. So amazing. I am so glad to know you, Bear. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
I really have enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having me.
Ah, it's been a pleasure.
Queer Family Podcast.
Whew. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I enjoyed it. And if you did enjoy it, feel free to listen to another or watch another. I have so many episodes for your listening or viewing pleasure. Just go pick one and enjoy. There's a lot. There really is. And also, if you really do like this show, please, I know I say it all the time, but please do consider supporting the show on Patreon. You're just going to go to patreon.com/thequeerfamilypodcast. You're going to pick a tier. You're going to join and you're going to get that bonus content. And you're also going to get my love and adoration for the rest of my life. I love you all. Thanks for tuning in. Keep on tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Mwah.
Are you moving through adolescence with your kiddo, navigating the fear and worry that comes with this season of parenting? The Joyful Courage podcast for parents of teens is what you've been searching for. Real conversations about real challenges. Lying, screens, school, risky behavior, I cover it all. My name is Casey O'Rourke. I'm a positive discipline lead trainer and parent coach. I put shows out each week that reframe the messy terrain of the teen years and leave listeners feeling seen and hopeful. Check out Joyful Courage wherever you listen to podcasts.